California passed groundbreaking legislation requiring every healthcare organization in the state to share data. It was going to transform care coordination, break down silos, and revolutionize how health and social services work together. Then came implementation. Legislative and governance support was missing. Organizations that have never talked to each other are suddenly supposed to share their most sensitive data. And everyone's asking the same question, now what? My guest, Timmy Leslie, has spent 20 years in the messy middle between ambitious health policy and operational reality. As the president of Blue Path Health and the executive director at Connecting for Better Health, she helps organizations figure out how to actually make cross-sector data sharing work. One design studio, partnership, and trust-building conversation at a time. This is The Policy Stack. I'm Lisa Berry, and today we're exploring what happens when visionary policy meets the ground truth of implementation. Hi, Timmy.
Hi.
So great to talk to you, my neighbor here in Northern California, on the podcast this time. So you've been implementing health IT policy for probably more than 20 years in so many different ways. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got here, and really what's different this time compared to previous waves of these initiatives.
Well, I just laugh because 20 years, I think it's almost 30 now. it's been a long haul. And, you know, when you look back over the decades, the first decade in the 90s, it was all about adopting electronic health records and really making the business case to do so. And then being able to, of course, have the funding to be able to make that transition. The last 20 years was around e-prescribing and all of the bolt-ons to the EHR and how do we help with adoption there. And then the last 10 years or so, or last 5 years with this focus on data sharing and data exchange, I think we're really getting real about it. What do we mean by interoperability? How do we spell it, first of all? And then what does it really mean to have meaningful data sharing that is high quality and able to really make a change and not only being provider-centric, but also, of course, patient-centric too?
Yeah, and also cross-sector. I think that's the most important thing that might have been kind of missing a little bit from the framing here is, you know, I worked now more than a decade ago in the meaningful use phase of adoption, which was the acceleration of adoption of health IT. But of course, they didn't invent EHRs in the 2010s, right? Many years, starting back in the 90s with the digitization generally of business processes, rather. And right. So we do that, but that's just very clinical, like between, you know, inside of systems, inside of clinical systems and health systems. And now moving forward after the acceleration of meaningful use and the adoption of clinical systems and maybe a little bit of talking between clinical systems that aren't in the same health system. Now we're looking at, okay, well, how do we share data across sectors and different types of data and systems and organizations? That's where it gets really complicated.
And I think that's what's different about California's approach. So you mentioned the data exchange framework, and that was put into practice through a mandate, a legislative mandate in 2021, I believe. And, you know, when you look at that approach compared to so many other approaches across the country, it includes social services. I mean, it defines outright that this is about cross-sector data sharing. And that's what's so exciting. I think that's really got me really back in the game. Is how do we figure this out? How do we have organizations that have never, ever talked to each other, let alone had the kind of, the data sharing access that is really required in order to really meet the bold goals that the state has to be able to meet housing and maternal health and, you know, child welfare, like all these bold goals of really moving the whole sector, all of health together. Really requires us to be together. So I think that's what's so exciting about this work.
Yeah, definitely. So how did you really personally get into this implementation side of policy? Because that's what I care about, you know, generally I find to be the most interesting thing, right? It's one thing to say, you know, oh, we wrote this amazing policy, we wrote this law, we passed this law, we wrote this bill. Implementation is a whole other side of the game. How did you get into the implementation side?
Well, my roots are the implementation side. So I started with my career, as you mentioned, internal into a health system of being able to help a hospital code its radiology department and its lab department to all talk to each other and be housed in a single data repository. I mean, this is really old school. Yet now where we are, it requires that co-mingling and being have a discipline of understanding what the policy is, what the regulatory framework is, so that organizations that are going through this work have both an understanding that what they're implementing is actually compliant. And that is really, when you start putting the layers of regulation and policy from the federal level across every state, and then every state has its own nuance, and then you put a payer layer on top of that of what their requirements are, let alone health systems and PC, you know, providers, you really start getting into a whole onion that needs to be unraveled. And I think it just requires that type of discipline that any organization is going to be helping that type of change has a real on the ground understanding of real world implementation and how that actually then meshes with policy and making sure that both of them are really together. So that's why I started Blue Path Health. You know, there's three legs of the stool. We have both policy, business, and technology coming together. I just don't think you can do it without all three lenses to really have quality work.
Yeah. So talk a little bit more about Blue Path and Connecting for Better Health. You know, how is the role of the consulting firm who's doing some of this implementation work and the nonprofit that's bringing together the stakeholders, how are they, you know, contributing to this implementation work happening in California right now around DXF?
So Blue Path Health is my firm. We've been around now for 12 years. I'm really proud to say a woman-owned small business here in California. And when the data exchange framework was passed, and actually even before that, when our governor and our legislative leadership had that twinkle in the eye that they wanted to do something around very meaningful around data sharing and data exchange, we pulled together a coalition to provide that backstop to that legislative leadership and administrative leadership to say, yes, go and don't put your foot off the gas. We have to really have this type of meaningful, this type of leadership in order to be able to move change across the state. So we pulled together a big tent, organizations that really have, you know, something in common that we know we can do better, that we definitely need to define the rules of the road, and we need to have a very clear pathway on how to get there. And we need the state to be able to move the big rocks that are in front of us. So that's the coalition. Our coalition keeps growing every year. We have a huge distribution list. We meet twice a month to be able to really put a real light on what's working in the state as well as what's working outside of the state. So how do we learn from others? How do we learn from others that are really doing that really meaningful work right here, right now? And then we also have, real advocacy, education, and technical assistance that we bring to the table as a subject matter expert.
Yeah, definitely. Innovacer is a new supporter of Connecting for Better Health, but certainly you and I have worked with many of the health information exchanges, the nonprofit, and the private HIEs across the state. I think what's unique about California's landscape that folks may not know if they're coming in from outside or, you know, not part of what we do is that California has a decentralized structure of individual organizations, nonprofit HIEs working across the state, as well as many private companies like Point Click Care who do a lot of interoperability and data exchange across the state. So it's there's not really a much of a central coordinating role from the state itself, compared to other states like New York, for example, that has a statutory, a central coordinating role in a quasi-state agency. So truly a complex landscape, partially organized, similar to Texas with sort of partially organized, very, very large state with large population, different parts of the country, different types of data exchange. So really shows how important it is to have some kind of coordinating something, whether it's a Connecting for Better Health or somebody trying to bring those stakeholders together, because it really wasn't there.
Absolutely. You know, California has been really the Wild West in terms of how we think about intermediaries, how we think about, you know, the state's role in exchange. So until the data exchange framework, you know, I've had experiences, again, this is looking decades ago, where we didn't even know who to talk to at the state if we needed help. We didn't have the health plans around the table, ironically. And now, you know, now it's, you know, getting major other stakeholders to the table. So, yeah, having this mandate in place is, I think, an important forcing function to allow us to really have the place and the space to be able to make meaningful change. Without it, I think we would still be out there, you know, trying to kind of glue stick everything together, really.
Not really patching it together.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So tell us about where we are right now with implementation, right? You know, there's the participant directory. It's not fully filled out. It is a requirement for folks to sign the agreement. It's a requirement to be part of it. But what's actually happening in implementation today?
We have, I think, over 4,000 participants that have signed on to the data sharing agreement. And when you talk about the, where you're referencing the participant directory, that's the second step. So first step is to sign the data sharing agreement. Now we're going to agree to the rules of the road. The second step is to be able to then enroll all of your providers and be able to designate how they are going to be connected and which intermediaries are they using or other types of steps. That second step is another administrative step, and we need to make sure that we put the incentives in place to have organizations fill out that next step. I think that we have a lot of work to do there, but the more that we can actually hold each other accountable, which is what Connecting for Better Health really stands for, be able to make sure that we have clear governance and accountability. And I think there's such a key piece there where we hold each other accountable. That's where really good work will happen. So if I've signed the data sharing agreement and I've signed the participant agreement, and now I want to share with that hospital across the street, let's ask, have you, it looks like you've signed the data sharing agreement. Let's make sure you actually fill out that second step so that we can move forward with our exchange.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, I think you know this pretty well, but like you just said, why is technical interoperability only the very beginning of data sharing? You and I have probably discussed many times how truly we're not in a place where there's a technology problem. It is very much a coordination, organizational problem. Every hospital certainly that has an EHR that's certified can share data. Now you move beyond, you know, clinical care, you move into social services of different types. There may be, you know, less connectivity, but why is the technical interoperability part only really the beginning here?
To be able to have meaning, I always call it meaningful data sharing, especially grounded in high or priority use cases. It's so much more than being able to have an organization be able to send data from one into the other. Think about it as our fax machines. How do we replace the fax and make sure that the information that's sent once is only sent once and that you have that information at your fingertips and you don't know just enough that now it's going to open a cascade of phone calls and additional poking around other portals. So that's where I think it really gets down into, okay, what do we mean by the interoperability? What do we mean by meaningful quality data sharing? Is that the data that is actually sent from one place to another is sent real time, is sent and responds real time, and that the information that's sent is everything you need to know about that specific use case?
Yeah, definitely. So let's get more specific, because again, the more well understood paths are truly, you know, clinical health system to health system data sharing. What actually happens when, let's say, a health plan or a hospital tries to share data with a housing organization? Obviously, a huge issue here in California and across the country, homelessness. You know, there are a variety of homeless information systems, networks, organizations, nonprofits, counties, states, counties, towns, et cetera. It just goes on from there. what actually happens when they try to share information? What does it look like?
It's messy. It's really messy. And if you unpack what's going on today, the systems, the homeless, or to just give you an example, HMIS. The housing, yeah, the HMIS systems, they're funded by another department outside of CMS. And the data that is historically captured there is very minimal and may or may not be the same information that the rest of the health system is capturing on that individual. So we actually just started a community of practice that's pulling together the HMIS and the counties and the health plans and the state to start really unpacking step by step, what are the data barriers to be able to have, good communication? And just give you an example, it's really difficult for health plans and the counties who are coordinating housing to be able to understand if they even have a shared client.
Mm-hmm.
Because the
basic
information,
demographics, basic PII,
basic. And then the rules around the sharing of the data too. So just health plans generally don't capture social security number, or how's that? And yet the HMIS systems do, and don't capture health plan numbers or your ID number. So just start mm-hmm. there. So we have to really look at the basic demographics, and you think about somebody who might be unhoused, they may or may not have a permanent address that is lasting to be able to provide that matching. So it's really difficult to be able to make sure, to be able to understand whether or not you have shared clients. That's step one. Step two is, once you understand that you have a shared client, who are the caseworkers or those that are helping to provide that coordination? That may or may not be known. And let's make sure that everybody knows that when you find somebody who's unhoused. Third, wouldn't it be great to have a shared care plan and know exactly what medications that person needs so that you can help them when they're in need? And then fourth, we are looking at, which I'm really excited about, is housing availability. You know, how this is a charge or a call to action to the state. Why are we so connected to housing in a county with these lines that we draw around a county? Mm-hmm. Why not think about it as a state, or frankly, border states? Why don't we think about where there might be somebody, where there might be opening for somebody to have a bed and also a roof over their head that they may actually prefer than where they are today? So just we have so much to give, so many resources that we can unlock. And I look at interoperability and data as being a way to do that.
Yeah, well, you're kind of calling back to one of the policy issues that we discussed in our last episode with Nikita Singareddy from Fortuna Health, which is, in, of course, the way Medicaid is administered varies dramatically across the country, various different types of Medicaid programs within programs. And of course, in California and in a couple other states, we manage all this stuff at the county level, which is important in some ways, and also probably just exacerbates the issues you're talking about when it comes to housing, right? It can be so hard and so challenging for the smaller counties in California to manage all these different systems. So a county like Alameda has probably a dramatically different amount of resources around homelessness, you know, HMIS systems, you know, sub-agencies around that, versus a county like Mendocino, where I'm from, which has far, far, far fewer resources and probably even less technology or ability to appropriately share data or identify the answers to the questions you just asked, right? Like, is this a shared client? What are the resources we have available, and how do we connect that? I imagine when we talk about like actual data sharing, we're shipping around, like, at best, SFTP files, right, from these systems. I mean, I have to imagine that there's a lot of Excel, there's a lot of, you know, very, very basic data sharing. We're not talking about, in most cases, anything more sophisticated than that at this point.
Yes and no. Okay. There are a lot of case management systems that are out there that are in place, and we are helping through California has been working on an initiative called CalAIM for the last 5 years that also reinforces that cross-sector data sharing that allows the health plans to work with CBOs and contract with them directly to provide enhanced care management services, which is really a high-level case management.
Yeah.
Really, I think about it as it's really phenomenal, the change that can really help and help those that really need it, a way to be able to navigate the system. Gosh, we all need it, right? And community support. So being able to make sure that food and housing and those basic resources are coordinated and available. And through that work, I think we've really seen a focus on building capacity across the CBOs and that data capacity.
Yeah.
So we are seeing them move from Excel spreadsheets to having more, HIPAA compliant case management systems that allow them to have a shared care plan and to start looking at intermediaries that may be doing all the big muscle work, the HIEs in the state, being able to pull together the clinical information, but then, really starting to think about how those CBOs are able to augment that clinical information with the needed social needed information and having them both have access to that information. So yes, I think we are starting from scratch, but there's no better way than just to do the block and tackling to be able to help, raise all boats.
Yeah. So that actually takes us into something I really wanted you to share more about, because you're talking about how I would think about approaching this, right? You say, okay, we've never shared data in this way before. We need to figure it out. We need to have shared definitions. We need to know what we're talking about. When we're talking about a client or a patient, what does that mean? How do we identify those overlaps? What about these encounters? How do we recognize each of them, right? We want to bring folks together, sit down and try and work through those differences to actually be able to truly exchange data to meet, whatever the use case we're trying to meet in a cross-sector data sharing world. So one of the things that you all do is this design studio idea. I'd love you to talk more about this approach. Like, how did you get there? What's a design studio? How does it work? Let's start there.
Well, I think it goes back to how do you marry implementation with policy?
Right.
And as we were going forward with a lot of the work here in California around the data exchange framework, the policies were being set, policies and procedures. And these are the rules of the road that all the organizations need to abide by. And we would get so far along the road of being able to say, this is something is final. And then another organization and another voice would come in and really take us back, another 10 steps. To go and research and figure out whether or not it would work practically on the ground. And that becomes a cycle. And I think many organizations feel that just individually too, right? That organizations will work with another organization and kind of get everything worked out. And then another organization comes in and says, oh no, we can't do that. And then you're back to square one. And I think that that is where we're looking for a methodology that puts the patient at the center, that has all the organizations incentivized to make sure that the providers and the patient get everything they need in order to make a successful journey, whatever that, we call it a use case, whatever that use case is, or the patient journey. And what's brilliant about this is I call it a give and a get. Every organization has a give. They have information to give in order to make sure that this journey is successful. And they have information that they need to do so as well. And when you have multiple organizations coming around the table all at the same time, to be able to understand each has something to give and get, it's magic. It works. And our design studio, where we took a page out of design thinking, of how do we bring organizations together, have them commit to just bare minimum to a process that gives them at the end of the day a fully fleshed out use case with the data requirements and all of that overlay of policy and regulation that they can then go. They can hit go and they can go forward with their last mile of implementation. And so we, over 6 to 7 weeks, we have set 6 sprints. So we pull organizations together. One organization says, I need help with housing. We go out and work with them to figure out who their partners are in that journey. and ask them to participate in a design studio and have to commit to 1 hour a week. And we do all the heavy lifting. So we'll do all the interviews outside of that design studio with the IT departments. You know, we'll go and make sure that we're matching everything at the compliant level, getting information they need week to week to be able to make decisions. And then at the end, they have this beautiful use case that looks at real world, what is happening today in order to support that patient's journey. So if it's housing, it's a street medicine provider, for example, encounters John, who is unhoused, and that street medicine provider then has to, all of the different systems that information, that street medicine provider has to go through in order to be able to just get John into a coordinated system of housing. And then what happens, and this is a real use case that the team up in Sacramento developed, what happens when he loses his temporary housing because he's admitted into the hospital mm-hmm. for 12 days and then now has to go through that whole process again at discharge of the hospital. And it was incredible what we uncovered and the learnings, both not only to those organizations that participated, but the state and the county as well. But we have multiple of these use cases, both completed and in flight. And I'd welcome anyone who's listening to take a look. They're at Connecting for Better Health under our sandbox, our community sandbox. And it's just a great library of our hypothesis is that we do this once, other organizations can pick it up and use it. 80% is done.
For sure, for sure. So what are some of the challenges that, you know, the folks who are participating in these design studios have encountered? Like, can you give us some specific examples of these data didn't flow the way we thought they were going to, or this was an insurmountable barrier or something that was really hard to overcome between different stakeholders in a particular use case?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ahas. I'll call out the state on this one. That street medicine provider use case that I just walked through. If you can't find John in your EHR, so he has not been at your clinic, he does not have an assigned PCP, and you go out and you look at through the federal network to see whether or not anybody else knows John, and nothing comes back. What's your next step? Your next step is to go into the state's database to see if John is enrolled in any of the Medi-Cal managed care plans. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know this until we went through this use case, but in order to do a search for John in the state provider's database, you have to know John's social security number.
Oh, wow.
You know, how many people who are unhoused know their social security number? How many of us know it? So I know mine pretty well,
but I imagine it's hard for connecting, you know, across all these different people and service providers and, you know, clinics and whatever else, you know, who knows?
Right. And I look at my daughters who are in their 20s. The social security number is not memorized like it was for us because everything is in our phone, right?
Right.
So let alone do I know their phone numbers by heart. So, you know, I think that it's a real barrier, and we need to have better ways to be able to get that information at the fingertips of somebody who's just trying to make sure that this person is getting the help they need and not to say, you know, come back in 7 days. That's not the answer right then and there. Right. We have so much that we can do.
But it's really the question of, like, you know, why are there are resources, and we as a state and as a country spend a huge amount of money on this, and yet people are falling through the cracks every single day, every single minute. So it's a really important question to ask. It's like, why are those data not being connected? Why can't we map between them in a way that's, you know, safe and privacy preserving and whatever else, if somebody has truly consented to have these services? But why is this so difficult? You know, it's truly remarkable.
Well, and I think that that's why these design studios are so important, because we can all talk at the level, you know, at the state level, even at the county level, that this is the way things should happen, but they're not happening. They're not happening today the way they should happen. And I just don't know. I haven't seen it. If anybody else has a better way of doing this, please let me know, because it requires work. And it requires the kind of time and dedication to be able to have these conversations that are daisy chained. You know, this is not just one organization talking to another. This is not just what happens with an alert coming from an ADT to the PCP, which may or may not actually get there. It's combining, having all these different organizations at the table at once and putting that person in the center. And I'm really excited to see the progress that we're making. We've moved not only from these high priority use cases of housing and, you know, referrals for enhanced care management and referrals to medically tailored meals, which is a big one. But we're now looking at quality data too. Mm. How do PCPs get the information they need for immunizations to be able to report back to get paid for their quality scores? How are we looking at postpartum care? All that data is out there. It's just, we just need to unlock it.
Yeah, that's great. One of the other things around implementation of policies that gets missed, of course, is the trust gap, right? You're talking about big health system and tiny community-based organization. You're talking about government at the local and the state level. You're talking about all kinds of different organizations and entities, right? Talk a little bit about the trust building or the mapping between organizational resources and styles, which I imagine must come out in those design studios.
Yeah, it is all about trust. I guess that just goes back to the give and the get. It's understanding that everyone has something, a role to play. And some organizations have huge roles to play and they recognize what that is. But if they don't have the necessary mechanisms in place, whether it's an individual, or, you know, somebody who is actually working on the front lines, we call it, or if it's some, you know, the policies and the compliance rules or policies that are governing the work that's happening at that organization. Sometimes I see this so often that a person, a front worker who's working with that client every single day, whether it's a PCP or a caseworker, they've been trained on the systems that are there today. Mm. And somebody needs to say or ask, how can we do this better? And whether that is at the executive leadership level, the clinical leadership level, I think at this point, it's the state saying, you know, everybody go up back and look at your processes. It's time to revamp them. We have the tools that are in place. And that's what's so exciting right now is this might be, the DXF may be a call to action for all organizations to relook at these systems and these processes that have been in place for so many years that are so outdated.
Yeah. And I have to imagine that, you know, the larger organizations like the health systems, those that are really in a very extraordinarily highly regulated space with very well-worn processes, the people who are at the front lines of those organizations, like receptionists, front desk staff, people who check you in for an appointment, they don't have a lot of leverage to change those processes as individuals. Whereas somebody who is practicing street medicine or somebody who is literally on the street being a caseworker, they probably very much experience a you're on your own, figure it out kind of mentality. Yeah. And those are really fundamentally different organizational cultures for the frontline people who are dealing with individuals and patients, clients, at that moment of care or interaction or whatever it is. And those are really different approaches and they might just feel different levels of autonomy and ability to improve processes that are so broken.
So isn't that the power of bringing them together and having those voices talk about what they have to do every single day to support the client or the patient that's in front of them? Yeah. And when they figure out that it's a shared client, then they can really start thinking about, hey, so let me give you really an example. One of the very first design studios we did was pulling a hospital system and a managed care plan together to talk about the alerts, the admit and discharge alerts that are sent onto the health plan. And that health plan said, boy, I'd really like to know or see in this alert what the language that that person speaks, because that makes a whole huge difference of who and what kind of case management we assign or send to the hospital to help at discharge. And there's so much focus on making sure that individuals who need help at discharge are getting the help. And the health plan said, well, we have it. We just don't put it in our alert, our message. So, sure, we'll send it to you. Why not? And imagine if that little piece of information, that one data set, is actually now embedded in all of the hospital's alerts across the state to all of the health plans, how much time and money we would save on making sure that those that are deployed to the hospital or resources that are being that surround sound that the health plan is able to deploy are the right ones.
Sure.
At the right time.
Sure.
It is mind blowing, but it's little examples like that that can make a huge difference.
Definitely. So here we are. What at this point is working well in cross-sector data sharing in California? At this point of implementation, and what's been much harder than expected at this point from your experience?
What's working well is we have over 4,000 organizations that have signed the data sharing agreement. So the word is getting out. We have so much ahead of us. But I think it's a journey, and we're on the journey. We're all on it. So that's great. I don't see this resistance out there that maybe we had seen before, or maybe we just assumed it was there, right? So we're all on this journey together, which is really great. Now it's going to be incredibly important for us to see it through. And that's where it's going to take all of us. It's being able to define these high priority use cases, put resources towards, figuring out what rocks are there and how are we going to move them. And I'm using the community of practice example that I gave earlier. There's so much that we need to do for housing to make sure that we get it right. But we have to do it. And I think that's the next step. Where I also think that there's a lot that we can do to be able to help hold each other accountable, whether it's report cards that we are able to give each other. Hey, I'm getting the information that I need. I'm not being sent to a fax machine to be able to, what are those mechanisms that we can put in place to be able to hold each other accountable?
At this point in time, what's working well in California's approach to cross-sector data sharing? And then really, what's been harder than expected?
I think what's working well is we have 4,000 organizations that have signed a data sharing agreement. I mean, that's phenomenal. The word is getting out. Now it's the hard part. Now it's the see-through. How are we going to really drive meaningful data sharing that's high quality? And organizations are going to be incentivized to be able to put the investment needed to be able to make those changes. I think that's just, that's along the road. Step one is we have a data exchange framework. We have rules of the road. Step two is to put them in place. We need to help each other do that. I think that there's enough momentum to be able to solve these big problems. And now having a place and a space to go to be able to figure out how do I get there? And didn't exist before, and it exists today. We now have these high priority use cases already mapped out. They're available. We have the data sharing agreement and the participant directory. So now you know where to start. Where are you going to start this journey? Who are the other organizations that have signed the data sharing agreement? That's an easy one. Start there. And then be able to then enroll folks that you need to be part of your data sharing journey. I think the other piece is being able to look at different ways that we hold each other accountable. And there are a lot of ways that we can give feedback to each other, whether it's a report card, you know, I'm getting the information I need from you. Hey, I requested that ADT example. I requested to make sure that language was part of your ADT. Something must have happened last night because it was reset and I'm not getting it, you know,
right.
That kind of feedback, and then being able to help scale it. So where and how have we made real success, and be able to share that with others and be really loud. I think the other piece too, that we can do so much more, is being able to bring that patient or the person with the lived experience into the fold. Which is part of the coalition work that we're doing, is bringing advocates, patient advocates, storytelling. We all have a story of where we have, have had missing information when we needed it in order to make sure that we were accessing high quality care. And we need to share that and have a place for it so that we can, again, block and tackle and make sure that we're solving.
Yeah, definitely. I think, people wanted or expected to see a switch on the data sharing light and all the data are shared and it's perfect. And I think, you know, understanding the complexity of implementation is really important to sort of temper expectations around timeline, right? You know, this wasn't going to happen in a year. And I think people were very quick to say, well, it's not working if it hasn't happened in a year. And you're saying, no, this takes quite a long time.
Oh, like I said, when we opened, it's been for 30 years, you know, it's, but you can see progress. You can absolutely see progress being made. I mean, I could have been doing this podcast 15 years ago, probably more than that, talking about e-prescribing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any of us, right, that have a prescription now that's in paper that we go and wait in line at the pharmacy? And then it may or may not be adjudicated, or may or may not find it in the system. No, we all expect that when we're at the PCP and there's a prescription made, that it's there when we are walk into the pharmacy, or it's delivered to our doorstep, or renewals happen automatically. You know, that's a really great example of where interoperability has worked. But, you know, what's different there compared to in general is that the consumer, we had a reason to be able to make sure that that happened, because it was just so much more convenient to be able to, and made the right business case for us to be able to direct our prescriptions to those where we could pick it up.
Well, I think that's actually a great example for a lot of reasons, right? There are situations where you have a perfectly convenient and wonderful experience. For example, with some of these new mail order pharmacies where it comes directly to you and you don't have to do anything at all.
Right.
Mail orders existed for a long time, but the consumerization of mail order pharmacy. But then, of course, even though those prescriptions are all electronic, there still are all kinds of barriers we put in place from a policy perspective or a poor implementation perspective, right? And so it's like, we can see the promise of that. And of course, like everything in healthcare and policy in the world, it's unevenly distributed, right? There are some magical experiences, truly magical experiences you can have with, you know, Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drugs or Amazon Pharmacy or whatever, right? But then there's also you waiting in the line for, well, it's 50 people deep at a understaffed, you know, retail pharmacy, and, you know, fighting prior authorization. So the fight continues, but we do see some good, you know, signs of life, and certainly a massive effort to really drive pharmacy interoperability over the past 20, 30, 40 years. So it's pretty, it's a great example, because there it works, and it also doesn't work still because of the barriers we put in place, right?
I couldn't even agree more. And if I could just add there, because I was working on the COVID task force for treatment, which is when Paxlovid was, you know, made available. And that data was really, so it's bringing, the example that you're giving is, it's great. Sometimes it works for us as an individual, but how do we get that data at a population health level and be able to inform public health? And we just had a simple question, which was, is access to Paxlovid across the state equal? Is everybody getting access to it? Who needs it? And we couldn't answer that question.
I'm sure.
Because of our systems. And there were and are I think, some ability to be able to get that data, but it was locked under, you know, a private organization's key. And that really demands public-private partnership to come together, break the glass when you need to, and or have a meaningful public health dialogue on where and how this information can inform the medication information could inform lots of public health initiatives. So that's a great example.
I'm glad
you brought it up, but we have it at our fingertips. It's just now go get it.
That's great. So it's a tense time right now as we're recording in fall 2025, to say the least, in the political world between the federal government and California and other quote unquote blue states. Given what you're focused on and understanding that cross-sector data sharing is an issue across the country in every type of state and every county and every situation, how do you navigate those political winds, which kind of always threaten to take us off course?
Oh gosh, Lisa, I guess my MO from day one has always been put your head down and do good work and good things will follow. And I think that's the motto and where we are right now, which is continue to do great work, bringing the resources together, what we have today, creating a really robust safety net where there are safety nets, and ensuring that the information is there and that we're doing things as smart as possible. And I think if anything, what's going on at the federal level is, and I guess I'm referencing cuts, you know, lots of cuts everywhere.
Medicaid cuts, others, yeah.
Housing, mm-hmm. Food, across the board, is that we have less resources and we need to make sure that we're deploying them correctly. We are creating, you know, pulling as much waste out of the system as possible. We're not duplicating services. And in order to do that, I think we need to have really strong data infrastructure and reliance and that trust, you know, that we talked about, and having organizations get out of their silos and work together.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it feels very much like there is ROI and there is using data for the right purposes and, you know, minimizing people falling out of the system. And we need that with fewer resources kind of urgently. There's no way to get around the urgency of not duplicating data or wasting any resources or systems we have in place.
Absolutely. I mean, the ROI has been proven over and over and over again. I think the hard part is being able to pull, you know, organizations all at the same time around the table to work on these initiatives that then are able to give back. Usually, you know, that readiness factor, you have one organization saying, okay, let's go. And then the others, you may have a big initiative that's happening internally and they just don't have the resources to dedicate to it. Or you might have an organization saying, you know, I'm not allowed to be able to share data, so I'm gonna wait this one out. And that's where it's just being really diligent and being able to reference these regulations that we have in place, reference the leadership that we have in the state, reference these big, bold goals that we all share. And frankly, you know, look at where the ROI is and where you can actually bill for these services that you may not have been able to bill for before, if you're able to be able to, you know, get these folks in the room.
Yeah, definitely. So we kind of can close out by talking a little bit about the policy stack involved here, right? So yeah. There's a law. There are a couple of laws at the state level. Then there are regulations written off of that. There are guidelines. There are also federal laws like 21st Century Cures Act, no information blocking. What other things? What other laws, policies, regulations kind of feed into this issue and create the complexity here, right? There's social services, homelessness policy. What else? What am I missing here? There's so many things intersecting.
Oh, there's food policy that's coming from the Department of Agriculture. There's child welfare. There's, which is our foster system. There's older aging adults, which is a whole other side of the equation where there are, you know, very specific organizations around coordinating care for older adults. We have Medicare Advantage plans. We have CMS fee for service. I mean, it is layers and layers and layers. But yes, even at the federal level, the new legislation from the Cures Act and on, like, that's really exciting. And the commitment to being able to have better interoperability and being able to use FHIR and other resources is great. But it's, again, we need to hold ourselves accountable to make sure that we're using it. You can have the ability to access a FHIR API, but if nobody's using it, what's the point, right? And the other piece too is, at least where we're looking at how states are organized in delivering care, it's not cut and dry. It's not large health systems that are paying claims. We have capitation, we have delegated groups, we have value-based system, we have bundled care. I mean, all of that matters. All of it matters. We have telehealth. So we need to bring all that together and figure out how we are layering the work. And again, putting the person at the center and solving for it.
That's great. What, just to close us out, what do you think the future of this cross-sector collaboration in health and social services will be in the future of cross-sector data sharing here in California and the rest of the country?
I'm really excited. I mean, I guess I'm always a glass half full kind of gal. But I've been working in this space, as I said, for decades. And I am just now meeting the leaders and the organizations that have been supporting our housing systems. I am just now learning their vocabulary of how to speak their world of what they do every single day. I'm just learning it now. I am just learning working with public health on how public health thinks about healthcare and how we are not divided. We are together. So that gives me so much hope. And yet I'm still really balanced. I mean, I work with, I'm in the community working with people who are unhoused and knowing all of the benefits that are available to them. How do we get them connected right away and then be able to find them housing, find them shelter? And it's still incredibly difficult. Wait lists are still miles and miles long. So I guess I'm really, really excited, but I'm also very grounded in the real world and the work that everybody is doing every single day to be able to put the pieces together, to be able to help all of us. So I guess that's where I am. I'm super excited, but grounded by the reality that we have a lot of work to do.
That's great. Thank you so much, Timmy. So appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you, Lisa.